Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan Political Podcast. In this week's edition, the team is joined by Macomb County Republican strategist Jamie Rowe and Caitlin Buss, the assistant editorial page editor for the Detroit News. Together, they discuss the latest downpour of Trump-related headlines and the impact it could have on Michigan voters. Will the electorate become disengaged by a possible Donald Trump versus Joe Biden rematch? And whose moment in the spotlight is approaching ahead of the 2024 elections? Additionally, President Tim Hostie of the Coalition Protecting Auto No-Fault discusses the recent Michigan State Supreme Court ruling allowing catastrophic car accident survivors to have their long-term care coverage unimpacted by the 2019 auto insurance reform and its reimbursement reductions. And Michigan State Capitol Commission Chair Bill Candler talks about an incoming firearm ban for the Capitol building that will be voted on later this month. Now here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber with MERS editor Kyle Malin and executive reporter Andrew Miniker.
Thank you to Mark Bayshore for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. We have MERS News editor Kyle Malin joining us today, and we'll be joined by our publication's executive reporter Andrew Miniker in a little later. But we are commencing today's episode with a special roundtable discussion featuring Jamie Rowe, a Macomb County Republican strategist, and Caitlin Buss, the assistant editorial page editor of the Detroit News. How are you all doing today?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So last week started off with the governor signing a more than $57 billion budget for state departments and general government. But that news, you know, which should have been the summer season headline, one might say, was quickly overshadowed by other stories. We are still asking about what the fate might be for the 16 Trump electors that signed and submitted electoral college certificates claiming that Trump won the 2020 election. We have former GOP attorney general nominee Matt DiPerno, former Representative Rendon, and Westland attorney Stephanie Lambert facing criminal charges for allegedly attempting to access and tamper with election machines after 2020. And of course, I'm like getting out of breath reading this. Former President Donald Trump himself was indicted last week in relation to what his involvement was in the January 6th riots at the U.S. Capitol. I mean, I think it's safe to assume there's a lot of Trump-esque headline fatigue going on right now. But Caitlin, how does this all set the tone going into a new week here in Michigan? And how does it affect the present day political conversation in our state?
Well, I think we have a really remarkable political atmosphere right now. I mean, both of the leading, candidates for 2024 president are under investigation in one form or another. I think there is probably a lot of fatigue among voters of the Trump stories, but also of the Biden stories, and just sort of this current state of affairs. And I don't know how that will ultimately affect if those nominees will end up changing. It doesn't seem like Republican voters are necessarily intending to turn away from Trump, depending on how these criminal charges go. I don't know what will happen with the Biden investigation, but it doesn't seem to be necessarily dissuading people from these candidates. So I'm not sure if that says more about the electorate or about the candidates themselves, but it's a really remarkable time in our political history.
What do you think, Jamie?
You know, I think that the Democrats have made the decision that they are going to go on what we like to call lawfare against their political appointments or their political opponents. And what's amazing is if you look at the Jack Smith indictment of President Trump on the January 6th indictments, he states, as it pertains to the fake electors, that they were tricked or duped into signing these things as a result of the criminal conspiracy. But Dana Nessel's indictments here in Michigan are that they knowingly and willingly were a part of this criminal conspiracy. Both things can't be true. So either they were duped and tricked, and so that they should be witnesses, not indictments, or they knowingly and willingly, which cuts under Jack Smith's indictment. So those two things I think are interesting. You know, I find it interesting that we have an attorney general in the state who finds time to indict 81-year-old grandmothers or great-grandmothers from Pawpaw, but can't find time to investigate thousands of needless deaths in our nursing homes. And I think people are, and the reason why it has not impacted the polling numbers in a negative way is people see it for what it is. And it's nothing but political activism using legal means. And it is something that we have never done in this country. And I think it's extremely dangerous to the trust of the justice system in this country, particularly as you see Hunter Biden getting a sweetheart deal from a Justice Department for not paying millions of dollars in taxes, which is something from foreign sources, and also not registering as a foreign agent. And people see a two-tiered system of justice, which does not bode well for us going forward. So these are troubling times in the country. And my fear is that's only going to get worse as we get closer to the election.
But I've also heard the comment of people being, you know, concerned about the state of our democracy. So what is the level of morale right now? Are people just afraid of the legal system? Are they afraid for democracy? Or are they just so exhausted that they're about to become politically unengaged overall?
I think there is a deep mistrust. Obviously, we know there's a deep mistrust of institutions. I think in the past few years, it has really, you know, even among independent voters who weren't necessarily Trump supporters, there's obviously this is an activist federal government. And I think that, you know, people of all political stripes are seeing there's just no way to look at these indictments, to look at that, like Jamie said, the two-tier system of justice, and not assume that there might be political motivation behind these charges in either direction. But Trump is seeming to get a treatment that I don't know that we've seen, you know, of any political actor in history. It is kind of a concerning state of treating a past president this way. And the charges better be very substantiated and, you know, severe to justify what's going on, where I think we risk alienating people from the Justice Department, the FBI, all of it altogether.
I completely 100% agree with that. And that is the threat that we're facing. The threat to democracy right now is our system is based upon trust. Ultimately, the people have to trust that the government is acting in their best interests. And I think when they see one-way justice, that erodes that trust. And it's all coming from one side. You know, there are no Republican prosecutors out there trying to put Democrat operators in jail. At least not that I'm aware of, and certainly not in this state. And I think that's one reason why you see Trump's numbers not going down. I mean, if anything, he's getting stronger within the Republican primary. And if you look at the CNN New York Times poll that was out last week, showed the race tied 43-43. And I think the Democrats better be real careful about what they're doing here, because if they think that the greatest threat to democracy is the re-election of President Trump, they may be doing everything in their power to ensure it happens. And that is a problem. And I also think that we could have a situation where we're going to have far lower turnout in 2024 than we saw in 2020, for instance, if people just say a pox on both their houses and stay home. And then that rhetoric gets even worse because it becomes a base turnout election. And we'll see what happens. But it is an ever-evolving political environment, and it's got some landmines in it right now, in my opinion.
You know, I want to switch up the conversation a bit. Caitlin, you had a column published last week about former Governor Rick Snyder making a comeback in Michigan politics to rally for Republicans ahead of the 2024 state House elections. How do you think these two worlds collide? One where Trump has overwhelmingly taken over the headlines for the presidential primaries, but then there's this other world where there's this attempted Snyder era revival going on for Michigan Republicans. What are some of your thoughts after writing that column?
Yeah, I think there's two things going on. There's both kind of that national conversation, which has affected Michigan, I mean, no, almost more than any other state in the country. I mean, the Trump drama has really affected our local politics, our state politics. In the last fall's election, you also had the issue of abortion, which drove just huge turnout on the Democratic side. So they took over Lansing. They've had 6 or 7 months now to show kind of where they're going and what the agenda is. And I think that even these defected Republicans who have been sitting out since 2016, 2018, when they just had Trump fatigue and honestly switched to the other side. I mean, some of these people actually came out and endorsed Whitmer in the last election. They kind of said, you know what, the Trump narrative, whatever is going on nationally, we have to start protecting our local base. And the state is at a real, you know, perilous point because we've overturned so many of these economic policies. Obviously, culturally, the state has gotten a lot more progressive under Democratic rule. And they see the House as kind of the first place for them to go in this chess game. If they can win back the House, and that requires a coalition of people that hasn't been together in many years. But they see some potential there, and hopefully they can stem, you know, their thought is some of these policies that have already been reversed. I think they're just kind of going to try and stay out of the presidential stuff. They know it'll drive turnout, but hopefully focus on, you know, what's going on in the state and what they can still, as Rick Snyder kind of expressed, you know, salvage of the progress they made coming out of the lost decade in the past, you know, 15 years.
You know, when it comes to Michigan voters right now, Jamie, and you're especially based in Macomb County, where would I dare say there's a lot of reddish, purplish voters around, you know, what headlines do you think they're paying most attention to, and what issues are they most upset about?
I think the thing that people are paying the most attention to is what impacts their everyday lives, and that's inflation that has gone up dramatically over the last 3 years since Joe Biden's been in office, and it's driving prices through the roof and making it more difficult for them to serve the needs of their families. I think that is number one, first and foremost, what is driving people right now. And then they see sort of out of control government. Just the answer to everything that comes from the Democrats is bigger and more government, which drives up inflation, which we saw our credit downgraded as a nation last week. This is the amazing thing to me, is that last week Fitch Credit Rating Bureau downgraded the faith and credit of the United States of America. And the news media, the national news media in particular, was busy covering the daily antics of Donald Trump. Now, the downgrading of our credit rating, which means we pay more for debt and we're piling up ever more debt all the time, and soon service on the national debt is going to be the biggest single budget item in the bloated federal budget. And that is not good for the American people, because ultimately they have to pay back that debt burden. So I think things that affect people's pocketbooks are what really is driving them right now, which is why you see Joe Biden's numbers continue to tank. Pile on top of that, the other stuff of using the justice system in a political manner. And it's a recipe for disaster for Joe Biden. I do not believe the Democrats are going to nominate Joe Biden. I don't think they can. I think almost any Republican, including Donald Trump, can beat Joe Biden next year. And ultimately, I think that he will be replaced as the leader of the Democrat Party going into the campaign next year. And just one quick thing on the Governor Snyder. You know, it's got to be frustrating for Governor Snyder to have watched in the first 6 months of this total Democrat rule in Lansing for the first time in 40 years, almost all of the achievements that he had during his time as governor undone. So it does make perfect sense for Governor Snyder, if he does choose to get back involved, to focus on something like the state house, which is something that can be taken care of immediately in the next election, and can help put a check on sort of the dismantling of good government that we've had here in Michigan for some time. So the first report that the House Republicans did, where they outraised House Democrats, was encouraging, in my opinion. And it's time for Republicans to group together and really focus on the state house. I do think that needs to be our top priority next year.
You know, I have a question, though, about that formula. I mean, it seems that as we try to figure out what's going to be everyone's big issue going into the 2024 elections, it seems that for Democrats, that issue could very well be democracy for them. And that would involve kind of getting into collisions with Donald Trump and the Trump base. But for Republicans, I mean, Is it a safe move to just kind of snuggle yourself up into the Snyder era business savvy blanket? Or are you going to have to get involved in that battle?
I don't think there's going to be a whole way to avoid that battle. I think that battle is coming, and it, and it's going to be a part of it. You know, this whole thing about, oh, they're protecting democracy. You know, the thing is, democracy worked in 2020, quite honestly. Even January 6th with what went on, the electoral votes were counted and recorded that day. The Constitution did its job, and I give credit to everybody who was out there that, that it worked. Not one state was overturned. Nowhere were anybody's votes denied. So this idea that democracy itself is at stake, I think our justice system is at stake. And quite honestly, that also impacts democracy. So, you know, as far as cozying up the Snyder era policies, fact of the matter is what Governor Snyder's doing to get funds in to help elect House Republicans is going to help amplify their message, which may, in fact, not be the Rick Snyder message. They may have some differences. I think, you know, Ronald Reagan once said that somebody who agrees with me 80% of the time is my friend and ally, not a 20% traitor. And I think that there are some people who may disagree with some of the things that Governor Snyder did. One thing I would take issue that he did perhaps is expansion of connections with China, which I think that we need to be very careful about. And Governor Whitmer has put that on steroids. And that's a policy I think that we need to review, particularly when it comes to expending taxpayer money.
Some of the situation has changed. So now you don't have some of those cultural battles that they're going to have to be fighting. And so, you know, they might be able to message to people strictly more on this economic stuff and on, you know, tax policy and stuff, that these kitchen table issues that people are worried about, and not have to focus on some of the culture wars that they had to for the past few years that they, you know, for better or worse, they don't have to deal with anymore.
You know, we have our editor, Kyle Malin, on now. Kyle, from a reporter perspective, I mean, what do you think is the morale right now among voters in Michigan?
I think there's a lot of fatigue. And I think that the interest isn't the same as what we saw in the last presidential election and maybe even the gubernatorial election, especially if we're looking at a rematch. I think that there's a lot of been there, done that. And I really am sensing that the public is, I don't know if they're as educated on what's going on as they should be. I think they feel like they get bits and pieces of information, and then they feel like they know everything they need to know. For example, like, let's just talk about a Trump indictment. I don't care which one you want to talk about, but who's actually gone through and actually looked at the indictments or read it and thought amongst themselves, you know what, this makes a lot of sense, or you know what, this doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, I just don't think there's a lot of critical thinking going on among the voters, and maybe there never really has been. You know, maybe I'm just kind of giving things a little bit too much credit, but I think in this social media world, I think we just kind of pick up things, little bits here and there, and then create our own version of the truth or reality, which I'm not sure is really a good thing.
Personally, Kyle, I think that's a great observation. I think one thing that we've had over the last several years, and no offense to the fine journalists who are on this call, but there has been an erosion of trust in the news media. I think particularly in the national news media. I think local media is trusted more so than the national news media is. And you have a great democratization, let's say, of how news is received by people, whether they get it off Twitter or off Facebook or off, you know, some other form of social media. They find voices who they trust, many of whom may often reinforce what they already believe, and that's where they get their news. And I think that is how you get sort of this great divide going in this country. And I think one of the ways in ultimately, like I said earlier, I don't think Joe Biden's going to be the nominee for the Democrat Party. And I honestly don't believe Donald Trump's going to be the nominee for the Republican Party either. And I think that you are going to find new voices that are going to rise, which is why I think the debates, particularly in the Republican side, presidential primary debates are going to be very important, because when you look at the polling that was again out last week, it was, one of them said 45% of Trump voters are not locked in, that they are with him right now. And I don't think that they know the candidates well enough, but there are some that are rising, and hopefully someone's going to rise there that can help bridge that divide. Another problem that I think existed for the Democrats in that polling was that non-college educated, non-white voters are trending toward Republicans. And that is a problem ultimately for the Democrats, because they are becoming the party of the educated elites, and the people who, you know, shower after work instead of before work are turning to the Republican Party. And this is one thing where I think that dual system of justice really hurts them. I saw something the other day about a police officer from Maryland who had $60,000 in unpaid income taxes and was sent to prison for 17 years, or not 17 years, 17 months. And then you see Hunter Biden with, and this guy had no gun charge and no drug charges. And then you see Hunter Biden with over $2 million in unpaid taxes, who's also doing crack and everything else. And he gets a sweetheart deal from the Justice Department. And I think that you have a lot of people who see the one set of rules for the elites and another set of rules for everybody else. And they are, I mean, they're going to turn against it. At least there's a threat they're going to turn against it, which is one reason why I do not think that they can afford to have Joe Biden on the ticket.
Now, we are near the end of our roundtable discussion. And again, I wish these could last forever because I enjoy hearing from everybody. But I want to conclude with a speed round. You know, this early in the game, you know, we're waiting to see who has their moment, rather it be a Republican presidential challenger who's going to have a moment on the debate, stage. Rather it be a viable U.S. Senate candidate in Michigan having a moment, or rather it be a inspiring state House candidate ahead of the 2024 elections in Michigan. Caitlin, I'll start off with you. Who are you waiting to see have a moment?
There are so many opportunities for potential here. I think Trump, you know, will have some pretty bad moments coming up. I mean, he's proven that he's still kind of that same guy. It's whether people or not want to tolerate that at this point, I think. But I'm excited to hear from Vivek Ramaswamy, and I probably butchered how to say his last name, but there's a lot of excitement on the right of center movement over him. I think some of his ideas, and it's been interesting to watch him try and pivot around Trump as well as DeSantis. I think we'll see some interesting stuff from him coming up, whether or not that can parlay into, you know, a real candidacy or not. But he's a newcomer, and I have my eye on him a little bit.
Jamie, how about you?
I agree completely on Vivek Ramaswamy. In fact, I'm going to see him today. I think I said it right. I think I'm going to see him today. He's in Oakland County today at 2:30 at the Oakland County Republicans headquarters and doing a town hall. And I'm going to go over and check that out. But the other one I'm waiting to see what he's going to do is former Congressman Mike Rogers, who I believe is contemplating a run for the U.S. Senate, because I think if we get Mike Rogers in, that puts a whole lot of first of all, it puts a Senate race in play. And I think puts a lot, whole lot of hope into the people who help fund Republican campaigns in this state.
Okay, Kyle, how about you?
Well, I thought I was going to be unique by suggesting Vivek Ramaswamy, but it looks like I'm not. I'm kind of disappointed that I'm kind of going with the crowd here, because I don't usually like to do that. But that was the first name that came to my head. And it's because he seems to be really engaging people, and he's something different. He's not Chris Christie. He's not Mike Pence. I mean, we've you know, kind of been around the sun already with Nikki Haley. I mean, maybe Tim Scott, but I don't know if he's really exciting people. I think this Vivek guy is actually exciting people. And I wouldn't be surprised if he does have one of those moments. In the Republican U.S. Senate race, I don't know if there's really anything I'm looking for. I don't know if anyone's going to have their moment. So, yeah, I guess I'm going to make it unanimous. I'm looking at Vivek.
I think it's also we might want to keep our eye on Governor Whitmer and see what happens with the Democratic ticket. And if she's going to have her moment and you know, hop on that. That's something we're interested in, too.
No, I don't know if I'm supposed to participate as well. I think I'll kind of share Caitlin's sentiment and say, you know, is Governor Whitmer going to have a presidential moment? Because there's a lot of theories going around. There's a lot of what ifs going around. So I guess we'll kind of wait and see if any of that comes to fruition. But Caitlin, Jamie, thank you so much for joining today's lengthy episode of the MERS Monday podcast. I'll give a disclaimer right now. But hopefully, listeners, you stay tuned because we have some great segments coming up. So for this segment of the MERS Monday podcast, we are joined by Tim Hostey, the president of the Consumer Protection Coalition Fighting for Fair Auto Insurance Laws, or CPAN for short, to discuss the latest Michigan Supreme Court decision in Andrea versus USAA case. Overall, the ruling states that the 2019 auto insurance reform, which was designated to create flexibility for drivers in their coverage plans, did not offer retroactivity language when it came to the 45% reimbursement reduction for the long-term and often at-home specialized care of the catastrophic car accident survivors before 2019. Tim, CPAN was quick to celebrate this July 31st ruling. Can you explain to our listeners why and what the journey has been like?
Definitely. So, yes, we really took this this as kind of an opportunity to celebrate it, because it is something that we have been fighting for many, many years now. And this is something that has negatively impacted about 18,000 Michigan residents who have been catastrophically injured. These are people just like you and I who got up, got dressed, went about their day, and in a split second had a very serious auto accident, changed the course of their life. They were able to go through with the good faith understanding that the benefits that they had were going to provide care for them. And in the middle of the game, all of a sudden rules changed. And we saw people across this state all of a sudden looking for what options are out there. And sadly, not many options existed. And this is something that we knew going into this case, that we felt, one, extremely strong about it. And two, we've obviously been fighting this the entire way to make sure we can get to this point. So, you know, it took a lot of time, a lot of court cases. And sadly, a lot of suffering and loss of life along the way. And that's one of the reasons why that we were just so absolutely elated to get the overall ruling that came down Monday.
Were you around in 2019 when this legislation was passed?
Yes, I was. I was actually involved with this going back to the legislation number escapes me, but it was back when Representative Pete Lund was chairing House Insurance, and there were some of that issues going on. So probably for about the past 10, 11 years, I've been working on this.
The reason I ask is because there was a discussion when this was being negotiated about whether there was going to be retroactivity with this legislation or not. And I don't think it was ever really made crystal clear to us covering it that it was going to apply, these cost restraints were going to apply retroactively. So at what point did you have the understanding that indeed these new reforms on cost cuttings were going to affect those who had already been in a catastrophic accident prior to 2019?
No, I mean, you're right. And that's one of the things that going back to, I believe it was Memorial Day weekend or leading up to it, when the House and Senate were working on, Senate Bill 1, as it was known. And of course, we've all heard the stories about the 100 and some odd page bill that was dropped in front of reps and senators just, you know, a mere hour or so before they were asked to vote on it. And really, there wasn't anything that was clear as far as what was going to be going on with that. And I think that's where it left it open to interpretation, essentially. And because it didn't clearly define that it wasn't going to go retroactive, it ended up rendered retroactive. And that's why this court case was such an important part of this, because it not only was something that we wanted to go on, because after talking with so many of the legislators who were serving when this law passed, we consistently heard, we never intended this to go retroactive. So we needed to make sure that got out, and that court case gave us that particular option. And then there's the constitutionality standpoint and the contract law standpoint as well. So again, going into this, we really never expected this to go retroactive. And when it did, we knew we had solid ground to pursue this.
So I know after all of that happened and everything came down, there were a lot of medical facilities that just shuttered their doors.
Correct.
And I'm wondering if this ruling is going to help some of those medical facilities that were shuttered be able to kind of bounce back.
Yes, it definitely will. But unfortunately, we can't just go over to the wall, flip a switch, and everything goes back to the way that it was. The post-acute care industry has been hit extremely hard, the past couple of years, and it's going to take time for them to rebuild. It's also going to take, families time to undo the extreme difficult times and just devastating impact that this law has had on them. While yes, you are correct that many providers either shut down or no longer dealt with, auto cases, some providers did. And those providers that did remain open and continue to serve those people who have been catastrophically injured have been doing so under very difficult circumstances and financial hardships. This decision will help them, obviously, because of what's happening, but most importantly, will allow them to strengthen the services that they have been providing and in turn provide better services to the people who they have been providing care for. So again, I do think we are going to see a positive change. I think you will see providers start to work their way back in, but it's going to be something that is going to take time.
I have two questions. I mean, I'm looking at a Brain Injury Association of Michigan 2022 report that shows that 78% is what was the reported loss in service. And then additionally, 42 patients that reported direct hospitalizations because of that reimbursement reduction. Is there a sentiment in the activists and the impacted community that this ruling is coming a little too late?
Oh, it is. There's no other way of saying it. Definitely is coming too late. And one of the examples that I can give, obviously, again, as I mentioned at the beginning, there's been thousands of people who have just been suffering because of this. They lost access to care. They had the care that they had reduced, combination of all that. But one particular story is extremely relevant. Brian Woodward, a well-known auto no-fault advocate. He sustained a spinal cord injury and was paralyzed from the shoulders down. This happened in 1983. Prior to the law changing, he lived in his own home. He worked full-time. He was involved in his church. He was involved in the outdoors, hunting, fishing, Little League coach. That was his life for many, many years. And because the no-fault law allowed that, when this law changed, the nursing, in-home nursing care and attendant care that he required could no longer provide services to him. He was forced out of his home into a nursing home. And he, unfortunately, for the next couple of years, would bounce from one nursing home to a rehab facility, back to a nursing home, back to a different place, and was hospitalized multiple times along the way. And the bottom line was the care he required was just not possible. And sadly, Brian passed away Monday morning, about 90 minutes before the Michigan Supreme Court's ruling came down. And I think that right there absolutely highlights how long this issue has been going on and the absolutely unnecessary suffering and loss of life that occurred because it took us this long to get to this point.
And right now, there's a lot of tweaks that individuals are bringing up of what they want to see in this reform. Do you think that this current Democratic majority in the legislature, do you think they're going to take the time this year or next year to go back to the drawing board?
I don't think they're going to go back to the drawing board in entirely. And honestly, I do want to kind of clear up one thing. We have been hearing for a while now that CPAN and the medical and rehabilitation industry want to scrap the law and go back to the way that it was. That is 100% false. We are just simply asking for a fair and sustainable fee schedule, not the current fee schedule that was crafted on assumptions and settled with oppressive rate cuts. We fully support a fair and sustainable fee schedule, but we need it to be something that allows us to keep our doors open so we can continue to provide the necessary care. So this is something that yes, we really do need legislative action, because we have a large number of people who reside within Michigan who were injured after June 11, 2019, when Governor Whitmer signed Public Act 21 into law. And unfortunately, more people get injured each and every single day. That is the population now that still is constituting the massive care crisis that we have going on that has to be fixed. So yes, we are hopeful that when they return this fall, the Michigan House and Senate prioritize getting this done so we can end this care crisis, mm-hmm. and make sure we don't have more stories like Brian's happen because of this. When, you know, we've always approached this that when Governor Whitmer signed this, both she and leadership in the House and Senate made a comment along the lines of, this is the highway to reform auto insurance, but we still have to install guardrails and exit ramps to make it work. That was over 4 years ago, and there hasn't been one legitimate legislative effort to fix this issue and put in those guardrails and exit ramps that were talked about. That's what we're asking, a laser focused fix on the fee schedule, not scrapping it, but just making sure it is fair and sustainable so that providers can do what they need to do and the people who are injured can get the care that they absolutely need.
And how seriously concerned are you that there are some legislators that saw the Monday Supreme Court ruling and said, okay, sweet, we got what we needed, I wash my hands clean?
There are some that were really concerned about this from the retroactive standpoint. So that is something that is definitely out there. That is something that I think there may be a few that are going to kind of drop off, or at least not have the overall interest to the same level that they had. But at the end of the day, I think what we have seen happen and what the past couple of years have shown is this issue is a significant problem. This is a care crisis, and this is something that we are going to see continue to happen unless we could actually put something in place that works. And again, we're not talking completely tearing it down, going back to where it was. And that's where I think the legislature as a whole, even regardless of the Supreme Court ruling, that collectively there is going to be enough understanding and importance behind this that we're going to be able to see this happen soon.
Tim, we're going to see an increase in our catastrophic claims association fees because of this Supreme Court ruling. Is that a fair thing to say? And I want to preface that by saying that we're down, our fees are down to $122. And prior to this law passing, we were at $192. And then we got a rebate to boot. So these fees are going to go up, right?
I mean, we've been hearing from the insurance industry even well before Andary was actually ruled on, that this was the reason why rates were going to be going up. You know, it's one of those things. I mean, this is something where people are just getting the benefits that they had purchased or they had with their auto insurance policy or was given to them through assigned claims when they were injured. And the MCCA and the catastrophic assessment was based on that for lifetime care. And so this is something that, while yes, the fee schedule changed that, the bottom line is these are people who were already injured. The MCCA was already counting, and those costs were built in. And so I have no doubt that the insurance industry will use this as a reason why rates are going to be going up. But as I mentioned at the beginning of this comment, they've been pointing the fingers at this well before this actual decision happened. So I kind of question whether or not that is the main reason, or if there's other factors that are just being masked by this most recent change.
So what you're saying is that if the fees do go up, they shouldn't have to, because the money that was collected should already be baked into the sauce for the people who are currently receiving benefits.
Correct. Yes.
So I'm wondering, as Kyle said, the bill of sale for this was kind of to the public was, you know, lowering auto insurance rates. And I'm wondering for how long that would go on before we could see anything that would be a, you know, a lowering of insurance rates because of and what that has to do with this ruling.
Yeah, well, you know, I kind of look at it as when Public Act 21 passed, you know, part of this, I mean, the whole goal of this legislative effort was to reduce the cost of premiums. I get that. I drive here in Michigan. I have, you know, a Michigan policy. So, I mean, I get that. That was the goal. It wasn't to take away care. And as we've seen play out, auto insurance rates in Michigan really haven't dropped, but the loss of care has, and that's a significant problem. One thing that I wanted to point out, you know, yes, CPAN is here to represent for those who have been injured in auto accidents. Yes, CPAN is here to represent those people who provide care for them. But we are also a consumer advocate for auto insurance policyholders. Our goal is to make sure that Michigan drivers pay fair premiums. But we also want to make sure that they have insurance policies that provide them value, that will give them the proper coverage that they need when and if they end up needing it. I hope to God nobody does, but people get injured in auto accidents every single day. We want to make sure that if that happens, that they have the proper care. And when you hear talk about some of these insurance companies that talk about how they've been saving people money and how this reform's been great, well, if you are purchasing far less coverage, or in some cases opting out, what are you actually buying in your policy? What are you getting with it? And so that's the part of this topic when it comes to overall premiums in Michigan that needs to be front and center. Yes, we want Michigan drivers to have lower rates, but we also want to make sure that we protect Michigan drivers and provide them value for what they are paying on a monthly basis.
So what's the game plan moving forward?
The game plan as far as for what the industry and CPAN are going to be doing?
Yeah.
So there's actually a couple things. I mean, obviously, as I had mentioned, this care crisis is still going on, and we need the Michigan legislature to work on this very, very quickly. We need to get this thing set. And the other part of it, too, deals with what I had talked about is rates. And we want to make sure that Michigan drivers are paying fair premiums. And the only way to do that is to take a look at all of the cost drivers and all of the actual factors that go into premium setting. And CPAN is working on something that will be released soon that really spotlights the main reason why auto insurance premiums are what they are, and the non-driving rating factors that are still very, very prevalent in the actual auto insurance system today, and in some cases even more prevalent than what they were prior to Public Act 21 getting signed into law. So it's really kind of a two-prong approach for us. Again, we're going to continue to fight for auto accident victims and make sure that they have care. But on the other hand, we are still going to continue to fight and ramp up our efforts to make sure that all Michigan drivers have that ability to get fair auto insurance premiums.
So what's the bridge? What's the bridge between now and where you want to be?
The bridge is pretty much we are just can continue to be throttled down full speed ahead to really get this thing moving. And, you know, we've been working with the, you know, members of the Michigan House and Senate for the past, you know, multiple months, the past couple of years, honestly, since this thing's been going on. And when they come back in the fall, we're going to be really kind of pushing that to kind of get that happen. And then again, we're really as a group making sure that we are focused on the consumer side of it. And we've got a couple town hall meetings coming up. We've got a study that's being done on the real reasons why rates are what they are within the state. And it's really kind of focusing on that so that we can get to that middle ground where, again, we have auto insurance premiums that people can afford, but also policies that, you know, provide them value. And again, making sure that everyone who has been injured and will be injured in the future can get the care that they're going to need.
When this was negotiated, this 2019 law, my understanding was, in talking to other people in the insurance industry, legislators, they didn't feel like CPAN was interested in actually negotiating into a common ground solution, that they felt like CPAN was just out there trying to kill this whole thing from happening. Do you feel like your experience these last 4 years has kind of changed that, and there will be a different approach in trying to reach new legislation?
Well, I want to preface that by stating that I don't agree with the fact that CPAN was not serious about, you know, talking about this. I mean, you can look back at the fair and affordable package we introduced in 2017, which had a fee schedule right there. I mean, so that goes back a couple of years before this even passed, and that entire package never got, you know, even a hearing on it. And then when you take a look at the efforts that we were doing leading up to Senate Bill No. 1, that was something there where we were actively engaged in conversations in the House and in Senate, and they knew what we were doing. And then all of a sudden, when however that Senate Bill 1 deal became brokered, the entire industry was quickly kind of told, we've got this thing set, we're going to make this happen. And any ability for us to have any further discussion or influence on how it looked stopped. And we were just there outside of House chambers watching everything happen while decisions were being made behind closed doors where we were not represented.
Tim Hostey, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, the president of the Consumer Protection Coalition fighting for fair auto insurance laws. Thank you so much and have a great day.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And she picks up all the pieces. She's going home.
Baby, I'm home, I'm home, I'm home.
Yeah, she's going home.
Baby, I'm home, I'm home, I'm home.
For our final segment of the MERS Monday podcast, we are joined by Michigan State Capitol Commission Chair Bill Candler. On July 31st, the commission presented language on a firearm ban in the state capitol, which will be voted on during the group's next monthly meeting. The measure would prohibit firearms, explosives, and other items recognized by Capitol security as presenting potential security risks from entering the historic building. Official security workers are authorized to be armed in this language, but not legislators who practice concealed carry. Throughout the years, around 20 legislators, a non-official count that has circulated through the grapevine, have been said to conduct business in the Capitol while concealed carrying. Bill, I want to start off this conversation. You once indicated to me that establishing this ban was a day one priority for you. Why is that?
Well, day one from when I realized that we had the authority, when I've been working on the restoration of the Capitol building for almost 40 years. In fact, I was headed the first demonstration project to do restoration. And that was the lobby coming into the Senate chamber. We restored that to what it would look like to give everybody an example. But that's what I assumed I'd be spending my time on. Then we were surprised a few years ago by AG opinion that said we had the authority, the sole authority to control the entrance and exit to the Capitol building, and we could be brought into the Capitol building. That meant right away that we had the responsibility. I think if we had the authority, we had the responsibility to deal with the issue of weapons in the Capitol building. And that 3 years ago, we had that protest, the people carrying weapons through the Capitol building, and really just obscene view of people up in the Capitol or the Senate chamber gallery looking down on people who are making decisions for the public in Michigan, all armed with rifles and things. That just let me know that was just wrong. So we started the process then. The only thing we could get done 2 years ago was the ban on open carry. But now we're at the point where the commissioners are willing to ban all firearms from the building.
So that was that spring 2020 armed protest that happened at the state capitol. It kind of essentially against the COVID-19 restrictions at that time. Did you ever think that there would ever be a need for a firearm ban, though, before that time?
Well, maybe before I might have thought of it, but not much before. I mean, we were proud. Michigan State Capitol is probably the most open Capitol building in the country. And we were very proud of that. We, you know, it's a public building. It's the people's house, we call it. And we were proud of the fact that we could keep it open. But, you know, the number of incidents of firearms and explosive kinds of deaths around the country, the interest seems like in recent times of bringing violence into politics made us realize that we're probably going to have to deal with the issue. So probably started a little bit before that date, but not much before that. We never thought we'd have to really ban things. 4 or 5 years ago, we wouldn't have thought of that.
So I know that in the U.S. Capitol, there's a firearm ban that does not, that does, it does permit, it does allow members of Congress to keep guns in their office. However, when it comes to state capitals, will this ban make Michigan an outlier or just part of the norm?
We'll be part of the norm. We're an outlier now, by far the most open Capitol building in the country. We'll be coming somewhere in the norm. There are a range of different specific policies throughout the many capitals, and different bodies make the decisions in different states. I think we're the only one that has like a commission that we do that makes the decisions, but we'll become really much more the norm.
You know, I mean, you were obviously Secretary of the Senate, you know, throughout the, you know, throughout half of the 80s. And I'm sure that there were probably people in the chamber with you who were practicing concealed carry, I can imagine. Why did you think it was, you know, why did you go ahead to make, you know, lawmakers a part of this ban and not allow them to have an exception of something that they already are practicing?
We just implemented a ban. We didn't specifically target the lawmakers. We just decided that we ban on weapons except for law enforcement. The concern is, you know, the idea is to keep people from having weapons in the building that they could use to harm visitors, legislators, employees. And if you include a ban for legislators, that's like the potential for another 150 guns in the building. Not 150 guns in the city, but 150 more guns in the building. And that seems like it kind of counter to the whole idea of controlling, you know, the presence of firearms in the Capitol building.
You know, but there are some legislators that are saying, you know, I'm still going to bring my gun. You know, I know that there's a lot of talk about, oh my gosh, what is post Labor Day going to look like when everyone comes back? Would you have any appetite for when you vote on that final language to add an amendment that would still allow legislators to practice concealed carry?
I think there will be such an amendment offered. I certainly would not vote for it. But I think that I would not be surprised if a majority of the commissioners don't support that.
You know, again, like I said, you know, you were Secretary of the Senate during more than half of the 80s, the Governor Granholm's legislative liaison. What do you think your reaction would have been to a ban proposal of this nature, you know, 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago?
Yeah, it's hard to say because, you know, it wouldn't be in the same context we have now with the political violence we've seen. But I could tell you that when I became Secretary of the Senate, I was really surprised to learn that all the sergeants at arms in the Senate were carrying weapons. None of them, only one of which were ever a trained police officer. They were just people who were hired for the job. I collected, one of the first things they did as Secretary of the Senate, collect all the guns and send them back to the state police who had lent them to the Senate because they were untrained people with weapons. So there's always a concern about weapons, but nothing like the context that we're in today.
And I know the Attorney General issued an opinion stating the Capitol Commission did have the authority to make this type of ban, but AG opinions can be challenged. I mean, how concerned are you that legal action will surface once a ban is implemented?
Well, I'm certain it will be. There'll be a lawsuit, at least one, maybe more. Who knows? But that's okay. That's fair. It's part of the process. People have the right to bring a lawsuit anytime they disagree with something. I'm not too concerned about it being, you know, and being successful, but there will definitely be legal action, I'm sure.
In that case, like who's responsible for representing the commission in that type of case?
It would be the Attorney General. The Attorney General is who represents the state institutions in legal action like that.
Now, is there like an expense concern of, you know, how much it would cost to defend such a legal action?
I'm not aware of that. That would be part of the, you know, a concern of the Attorney General's office. Wouldn't be, and I know nothing about their budget or what they have budgeted for lawsuits. But obviously, every day they're defending some agency of state government. I'm sure. So I'm sure they have a budget for litigation.
Given your career here in Michigan government, I mean, what concerns you the most about the changing nature of politics in Michigan?
I guess the most in Michigan and in the country as a whole, we just seem to lack a unifying goal or vision. We seem to be more concerned about our particular positions on issues than we are about our democracy itself. And we take it for granted. And all of us have. I did. I mean, I never thought we could be in a position we're in now nationally where it seems like our democracy is really up for grabs. And this next election is going to be pretty dangerous for us, I think, and the surrounding events. So I'm really concerned about the fact that we don't seem to have a love for our democracy, you know, and our way of life and government. We're more concerned about individuals and specific policies, and that's a problem.
What have been the biggest omens then that have indicated that this could be a dangerous election in 2024?
Well, just maybe one of the biggest things is just the heat of the nature of political discourse. It's much more, I don't know if speech can be violent, but it's really bordering on violence itself. I think it's just so harsh and so angry.
Now, when you were Secretary of the Senate, correct me if I'm wrong. Now, you were Secretary of the Senate while there was that last Democratic trifecta, correct?
Correct.
Now, what would you say are kind of some of the biggest differences of the Democratic trifecta that you saw and interacted with as Secretary of the Senate to today's?
Yeah, well, my time in the trifecta was pretty short because it was during my time as Secretary of the Senate that the Republicans took control of the Senate as a result of recalls and special elections. So it switched from a Democratic majority to a Republican majority in the Senate. I was kept on even after John Engler became majority leader in the Senate. I was kept on as Secretary of the Senate for a couple more years. So, you know, I worked on both sides. So as far as my job as Secretary of the Senate, it really wasn't a change. I mean, it was very much the same. Things weren't quite as partisan. You know, we would have issues every session that defined Democrat and Republican so that AFL-CIO could have their scorecard and the Chamber of Commerce could have their scorecard. There'd be issues that were specifically designed to separate people by partisan identity. But most of the issues, people voted their district. And it was surprising how many issues were passed by bipartisan votes then. It was a completely different environment.
And you were there when there was this historic switch, you know, when John Engler had taken over and won against former Governor Blanchard. And, you know, I think a question that I would have in relation to that, I mean, right now we have a lot of people in the business community saying like, oh, you know, Democrats have created a environment of uncertainty. And that's also the criticism they're getting from Republicans. Do you think when you were there involved with another historic switch 40 years ago, did that create uncertainty in Michigan? Did that create as big of changes as we're seeing today?
I don't think it created uncertainty, and I don't really believe that we've created uncertainty and uncertainty now. It's a change in after 43 years of one party control, things change. That's not uncertainty; it's just a change. And when it goes back the other way, it'll be just a change.
So I do kind of want to jump back to the conversation of the firearm ban. When are you planning on having the next monthly meeting?
Well, actually, we've been working on, as you know, we were planning on voting in the last meeting, but we got some last minute requests from the state police to make some technical corrections. We've gone through those. We've approved those now. So we're going to move our meeting up to August 14th. And so we're going to be voting on Monday, August 14th.
Now, you know, I know that you moved the Capitol Commission because I know in previous years you all were meeting in kind of like this smaller, like gathering space. It was like kind of like a dining room table in the Capitol on the first floor. And then you moved it up to, you know, the third floor where there was basically room for people to give testimony. A lot of individuals could come in. And I remember, I think we were talking about this. I mean, are you a bit surprised that the rooms haven't been as filled up?
I am, because I remember back to, you know, 2 years ago when we did the open carry ban, we had a lot of people show up for meetings. Well, a couple of them were during COVID, so they had to appear via Zoom, et cetera. But we had a lot more people attending. I expected bigger groups. I want to make sure we had room to accommodate them, they have the opportunity to testify. Our usual meeting room, historically, as you mentioned, has been room H65 on the ground floor. Very small conference room, usually has more than enough space. But I wanted to make sure that if we had a big crowd, we could accommodate them. Really surprised we have not had bigger crowds on the issue.
Do you want to make the Michigan Capitol Commission more accessible?
I mean, I think it is very accessible. We post our meetings as early as we can. We don't wait till the last minute that we're required to post legally. We try to do it a couple of days ahead of that deadline. As I mentioned to you, if we think we're going to have a big meeting, we accommodate by space. So I think the Capitol Commission has done a very good job of being open and accessible to the public.
Now, I know with these firearm detectors that are going to be operating following Labor Day weekend, they're passed through They are supposed to be easier to get through than the typical metal detector that you imagine. And also, it's going to cost $170,000 to lease annually. Have you heard any concerns about the price tag involved with this security equipment?
I've not heard any concerns, but I'm very surprised. I expected it to cost a lot more. But when we realized we could do the lease situation, that helped a lot because it's less expensive per year. And generally, people consider technology to be obsolete about every 3 years. So if we lease the equipment after 3 years, we can get lease new equipment and not be stuck with old equipment and figure out what to do with or how to pay for new stuff. So it's really quite a savings. I expect it to cost quite a bit more than $170,000 a year, frankly.
And I know that it was the Capitol Facilities, the Capitol Commission Director, Rob Blackshaw, who presented the proposal plan of where all these firearm detecting devices would go. And they are going to be located in front of those staff entrances where a staff member already needs a key card, a legislator already needs a pass to get through. Why was it important to include them at those entrances if these individuals already need official badges to get through anyway?
Well, again, what we're concerned about is people bringing firearms into the building. So that just if any place somebody's coming in, we wanted to monitor that and make sure that anybody comes in with a weapon who's not supposed to have one other than law enforcement, we can do it. So anytime we have a door for it that's an entrance, we want to be able to detect a weapon.
And what are your biggest predictions for that following Labor Day? Do you think it might get a little bit crazy when legislators come back from summer recess? What are you anticipating?
Yeah, I don't think it'll be crazy. I mean, it'd be different for people, but people in general, it'd be different for them in the Capitol building. But in general, people are accustomed to going through security things like this everywhere. You go to do it in and out of a store, in and out of a sports facility. It's just, unfortunately, a fact of life in our current situation. So I think people in general are pretty accustomed to that.
After this is all said and done, because I know you said next meeting, August 14th, what's next?
Well, we're looking at always, you know, what's the next restoration project in the building? Every time you do a restoration project, it begins to deteriorate the next day, you know. So the next thing you know, it's 30 years later, like a project right now to restore the inside of the dome. You know, we had to put scaffolding up from the ground floor all the way up to the dome. It took a month just to install the scaffolding. It's such a big project. And so those kinds of things occur all the time. We have to replace. We find leaks sometimes in plumbing in the wall. We have to tear out the wall and fix that. So there's always something. So our job is to make sure we maintain the building and its grounds. And so what's next is whatever next project we get funds to cover.
You know, I know that there was some talk last year to ultimately take some parking space behind the Capitol complex, behind the bureaucratic buildings, and turn that into a park. Do you have any interest in kind of some more projects like that? You know, some more parks, some more places that, you know, residents can visit. What's kind of on your mindset about those types of project proposals?
Yeah, we have talked about that, and we have spent some time thinking about that. And one of our commissioners, John Bowman, has really done it. Quite a bit of work on this over the years, and it's really an exciting idea. We haven't really, you know, we don't have any specific authority or plan to do that yet, but we're working on that, and we'd like to see that whole area around the Capitol building and state buildings enhanced, so it's really kind of more of a center for Michigan government that's pulled together with landscaping and markers, etc. So rather than just the gravel parking lots that we have there now.
After serving so long in the Capitol, being retired, you know, did you ever imagine that you would be making these types of headlines?
Not at all. Not at all. I never, you know, again, I wish the legislature would deal with the issue of guns, but they gave that authority to us. They gave it away. And since we have the authority, we have the responsibility. I'm just, you know, I love the Capitol building. I know a lot about it because I worked with it. I had an opportunity to serve. And the way I look at it, I'm just serving as a citizen. This is just what a citizen does. That's why, but that's what keeps our culture together mainly is what people do, not because it's what they do for their living, but because it's what they do, they can give back to their state, their country. And I just see it as a possibility or responsibility to be a citizen. And I'm happy to do that.
One last question before we conclude here. Have you heard any, you know, I know that it was this past Monday, that July 30th date where this language came out. Have you received any emails from lawmakers? Have you received any notifications of people wanting amendments? Have you heard any types of communications of opposition directly to you?
I've not gotten any emails. Had a couple of legislators talk to me about it, ask me questions about it, mainly the pro-gun people. I think there's a concern that, and again, it's just a different way to look at it. Some people think that this is an effort to take guns away from people. We are not taking a gun away. We don't have the authority to take a gun away from anybody. But we have the authority to control what comes into the building, and that's all we're doing. It has nothing to do with anybody with gun issues in general or anybody's ability to have a gun. We just don't want to have more weapons in the building. You talk to the staff in the building, and they're still very much on edge about, you know, that event 3 years ago really struck a chord with people, and it was fearful. I mean, it's probably a, you know, a cough away from somebody, you know, discharging a weapon and having a slaughter in that building when we ended up with the demonstrators and the state police facing off against each other right outside the House chamber. It was a scary day. And all we're doing is trying to keep weapons out of the building. And it's not, I didn't spend a career so I get to the point of taking away guns from people. Definitely not.
And how do those conversations go? The ones that you mentioned with legislators that are concerned about this? I mean, have they been productive conversations?
Well, I mean, they're productive in that we talk to each other, but, you know, they haven't convinced me that it's unconstitutional to you know, keep anybody from bringing a gun into the building. So, you know, again, that's we'll pass a policy of some kind or another, which I would not be surprised includes a ban or an exception for legislators. It probably will accept them. But and then we'll have lawsuits. And so when all that all washes out, we'll see what we have left.
Do you have any additional comments while we have you on the MERS Monday podcast?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I appreciate you taking the time to talk about the Capitol building.
No, thank you so much, Bill. And just to give all our listeners a disclaimer, Bill and I are doing this interview at the very controversial time of 9:30 a.m. on Sunday, because Bill is going on a lake trip. I hope it's okay that I share that with everybody.
That's fine. That's fine.
So I apologize if I sound a little bit of sleepiness. I am drinking an iced coffee right now in the middle of this interview.
Yeah, same here. Oh, not iced coffee, but I'm sleepy too.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. I hope you have an amazing weekend and an amazing week when this podcast comes out. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Hey, happy to talk with you. Have a good day. Thank you.
And that's going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much to our morning roundtable participants, Caitlin Buss, the assistant editorial page editor of the Detroit News, and Macomb County Republican strategist, Jamie Rowe. Additionally, thank you to Tim Hostey, the president of CPAN, and Michigan State Capitol Commission Chair Bill Candler. Going back to the roundtable discussion, I want to offer a shameless plug to our listeners. My goal for this podcast is to include weekly roundtable discussions. So if you have any ideas of what topics you'd like to hear us tackle or pundit voices who've been overlooked by present day media coverage, please feel free to reach out to me. I am extremely excited to hear any and all new ideas in this new position. Going back to my gratitude, I also want to give a huge thanks to the MERS News editor, Kyle Malin, and our executive reporter, Andrew Miniger. A post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am Samantha Shriver.